Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gatehouse Florida. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and I'm joined as always by Gatehouse Florida Capitol correspondent John Kennedy. Hey, John.
Hello, Zach.
Well, this weekend marks the first day of fall, and while it doesn't feel like fall in broiling hot Florida, one sign of the season is the return of state lawmakers to Tallahassee for committee weeks. We'll talk about some of the early topics of discussion in Capitol committee rooms, including gun violence. And we'll also break down a new poll that shows a very, very close race for the presidency here in always critical swing state Florida. But first, you all know what that music means. It's time to pick a number. John, did you come bearing the gift of a number this week?
Zach, I'm cutting back on the digits this week. It seems like my number is usually in the hundreds of millions, you know, some arcane budget number or the like. But this week I'm keeping it, you know, fairly simple. I've got a 65.
65. Nice, concise. I like it. I'm keeping it simple this week too, John. You go high, I go low. I have a 24. So that's 65 for John Kennedy and 24 for Zach Anderson. Remember those numbers, write them down, and we'll tell you what they mean in Florida politics at the end of the show. All right, let's keep rolling. We're going to start with the beginning of committee weeks in Tallahassee. Florida has a part-time legislature that is technically in session for just 60 days. But in reality, legislative committees start meeting in the fall, and they usually take their sweet time getting around to serious business. Typically, the first week is a lot of dry presentations from state agency officials, but this week there was a pretty high-profile committee hearing. After the mass shootings last month in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, Senate President Bill Galvano tasked the Senate's Infrastructure and Security Committee with digging into the causes of mass shootings and ways to prevent them. The first committee hearing was Monday, and John was in the room to hear what was going on. John, what kind of start did we see from this high-profile committee?
Yeah, Zach, I think people had different aspirations for this hearing, really based on where they come down on the gun debate. In other words, you know, is the availability of high-powered weapons a contributor to the mass shootings that we've seen across the nation and here in Florida following Pulse, the Orlando nightclub in 2016, and Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Broward County just last year? Now, participants in this week's Senate committee hearing seemed to sidestep the question of guns, and that frustrated some people. Senate Democrats on the panel were there, and they tried to direct the conversation towards guns, kind of generally unsuccessfully. And there was an entourage from Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, who were also in the audience, but no testimony from the public at this hearing. So there was a lot of data. A couple of criminologists from Florida State University showed how data is not that great on the number of mass shootings that have occurred across the nation in recent years, including, you know, whether they are fueled by hate groups or, you know, what is the motivator for these sudden attacks. You know, statistics will show that shootings with multiple victims often include family members, people who know each other. They outnumber the more random attacks. Those are the more random attacks are the ones that, you know, shock us and grab our attention. But they are fueling the view that these are happening with more frequency. Here's Senate Chairman Tom Lee. He's a Republican from the Tampa Bay area. He's trying to summarize some of the data conclusions in this soundbite here.
I got the impression from the testimony so far that mass violence hasn't necessarily increased as much based upon the federally adopted definition as one might think, but that the incidents have become more public.
And law enforcement officials, they played a role in this committee hearing too. They tried to emphasize that more attention should be paid to improving threat assessment techniques across police agencies and getting the public to go along with the idea of, you know, kind of generally the old adage, you know, if you see something, say something. That approach that may involve family members, mental health professionals, you know, others who come in contact with a potential shooter, that they should somehow alert law enforcement. But again, when Democrats tried to get the Florida Department of Law Enforcement Commissioner Rick Swearingen to talk about whether the availability of military style assault style weapons are a factor in these shootings, he tried to downplay the idea. Here's Swearingen talking.
The vast majority of these incidents are done with handguns and not with long guns. So 60% are done with handguns based on an average of the studies. 25% are done with rifles. And AR-15s and AK-47s, for example, would be a smaller subset of that.
So this three-hour hearing at the Capitol likely didn't give much direction to the question of, you know, what is there to do to try to stem another mass shooting. Policy changes, of course, could include expanding gun background checks and expansion of red flag laws that can result in weapons being taken away from what are considered, you know, troubled individuals. And voters next year may even get a chance to consider a proposed constitutional amendment banning assault weapons, although that campaign has many hurdles in front of it. Bottom line, no legislation was discussed this week. Lee, the committee chairman, said he could support expanded background checks, but he's one Republican in a Republican-dominated legislature that is very shy about doing anything that could run afoul of the National Rifle Association. So while there was a lot of focus on this hearing, it's frankly very hard to say whether it really advanced the ball very far on the issue of trying to stop mass shootings and reach what, you know, Senate President Bill Galvano had a goal when he set this hearing up to try to, as he described it, make sure that thoughts and prayers must yield action.
Do you expect, are there going to be more hearings, John? I mean, is this, is it not clear whether they're going to continue to scrutinize this issue, or could this be a one-off thing, or do you expect them to continue to discuss this? I know it's kind of hard to say whether they'll actually do anything. You know, some of this stuff comes together at the last minute, but do you expect them to keep talking about this issue?
Yeah, that's a good question. At the end of the hearing, we were, you know, several of us reporters were peppering Lee about, you know, what comes next. And he was uncertain at this point. It sounded like his marching orders from Galvano were to, you know, to hold this hearing, and then, you know, they'll kind of take it from there. So it didn't necessarily sound like that this was going to be the first of what was going to be a series of hearings by this committee. Instead, it's possible that, you know, it winds up just with legislation being filed, as you know, Democrats, Senate Democrats undoubtedly have a number of different bill proposals that are likely to, you know, make their way into committees as the January regular session begins, and also, like, there's committee weeks that are going to precede that session. So those bills could be referred to committee, but history as a guide shows that these bills don't get heard then by the committees, because the Republican legislature doesn't really want to take up anything that would, you know, limit assault weapons, assault style weapons, or reduce gun magazines, or you know, do anything like expand background checks. Now there may be a little bit more momentum this year to at least hear some of these bills. So I don't know. It's really a hard to say right now. Just, you know, whether we're going to have a continuing series of hearings that feature a lot of experts coming in, or whether we're just going to start the regular legislative process now after we have this one-off, as you said.
Well, it'll be a big issue to keep watching. It usually, this, you know, after a shooting, the gun issue gets a lot of attention and it sort of fades away after a few weeks or months, but it seems like we just have these shootings back to back to back now. I mean, it was a very violent summer with a number of mass shootings, and it continues to stay in the spotlight. So it seems like it'll be a salient issue up into and through the legislative session. And whether they end up doing much of anything is a big question mark. I mean, I think, like, after Parkland, which was obviously in Florida and involved children, the legislature seemed to feel like they had to do something, the legislative leaders like Galvano, and they did push through some gun new gun restrictions. They were fairly modest, but raising the age to purchase guns and the waiting period. And so Galvano has shown that he has an appetite for doing some of this stuff. And it was interesting that Lee did mention that he might be able to support background checks. So it seems like, you know, the majority of folks, especially on the Republican side in the legislature, are not all that interested in doing new gun restrictions. But there has been some appetite to do some of this stuff in the Senate in the past. So you never know.
Yeah, something could happen. And it does seem like something that, you know, it's possible that Republicans also may take a clue from what happens from President Trump and the Republican Senate when it comes to any kind of action that they may be taking on how far they're willing to go on gun restrictions. So, you know, that can provide some cover for state legislators if Congress also is looking to, you know, maybe expand background checks or introduce at the federal level the red flag laws that we've had in Florida now for just over a year.
And I think Trump is supposed to lay out what he is interested in doing on the gun issue pretty soon here. So we'll have a little bit more clarity going forward. But the big hearing on mass shootings got the most attention this week in the legislative committees. But there were plenty of other issues that got some committee love. Lawmakers were talking about abolishing the much maligned Constitutional Revision Commission, which meets every 20 years and last year was successful in passing a series of amendments to Florida's Constitution, including banning oil drilling in state waters and banning vaping indoors. There's a bunch of other stuff that happened. John, can you fill us in on some of the highlights from the first legislative committee week?
Well, this first week is sort of like legislative preseason. You know, the committee action, they haven't done this since lawmakers adjourned in May, and we'll have...
they're a little rusty, huh?
Yeah, they're still a little rusty. Well, we'll be having these hearings, you know, each month now, heading toward the January start of the regular session. But, you know, it's kind of like spring training in baseball. At this point, everything looks like it could be a winner. But you know, we'll see as the regular season.
So much hope right now. Yeah. So much hope for legislation is almost certainly not going to make it across the finish.
Season of hope. But legislators this week they got updates on the emerging hemp industry in Florida. The Florida Chamber of Commerce got Governor Ron DeSantis to join it for a pretty much annual call for legislation to reduce business risks of lawsuits. There were updates on the new law making texting while driving an offense that you can get pulled over for. Evidently, almost 1,000 warnings and citations have gone out in the first 10 weeks of the law. So, better put down those devices. And there seems to be a rising consensus in the legislature to get rid of the state's Constitution Revision Commission. Now, that's the appointed panel that meets every 20 years and last year put 7 ballot proposals before voters. But in doing so, they bundled several seemingly, you know, mismatched ideas like expanding crime victims' rights and extending the retirement age for judges. That was one thing that was put together. And you also had a ban on offshore oil drilling going with a prohibition on vaping in the workplace. All that, the bundling issue seems to have drawn everyone's ire, you know, even though voters ultimately approved all 7 of the CRC's ballot proposals. But it looks like this Constitution Revision Commission is going to become a subject of its own ballot amendment next year, and that would be to abolish it. That would have to go before voters. The legislature doesn't look fondly on losing its policymaking authority to any constitutional amendments, whether it's they're put on the ballot by the CRC or by citizens' initiatives, which we've talked about before on this podcast, are often a target for legislative interference. So this week, a proposed constitutional amendment getting rid of the CRC, right now it looks like it has a strong chance of winning approval in next year's session.
And Democrats and Republicans are supporting getting rid of this, right?
Yeah, it's a unusual coalition. The sponsor of it in the Senate, this is Jeff Brandis from St. Petersburg. He talked about how he had managed to get the think he called it the Baptists and the bootleggers together on this, because he had you know, union support, the National Organization for Women supported the idea of doing away with it, Democrats supported it, Republicans supported it, all the idea of you know, putting it back before voters. Now, this, you know, Constitution Revision Commission was created as a great reform back in the 1968 Constitution in Florida. It met in 1978, and then it met again before its most recent rounds. And, you know, the thing is, I guess, at the time that it was created, there were maybe fewer avenues to get things on the ballot. The Citizens Initiative effort, that was approved also or created in that 68 Constitution, but they didn't start, you know, flourishing until several years later. And now, of course, you know, they're drawing their own criticism because they're seen as things that special interests can pump money into to, you know, raise the appropriate number of petition signatures that they need to get on the ballot. And, you know, the legislature has been wrangling with some of the more recent proposals, you know, legalizing medical marijuana, restoring felon voter rights. Those kind of things have become issues that the legislature wrestles with. And,
right.
You know, so I think generally at the legislative level, there's a lot of opposition to what they see as an end run around their role as policymakers. And now the wild card is, you know, if they put it on the ballot, will the voters say, right, yeah, we want to shut off our voice?
I don't necessarily view it as a end run as much as I view it as duplicative. I mean, the people who are on the CRC are mostly, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but they're mostly appointed by the Senate president, the House speaker,
and the governor.
And the governor, right? So, I mean, if they all wanted to put stuff on the ballot, they can do that by putting a bill. You know, the legislature has the authority to put constitutional amendments on the ballot, right?
Sure.
So, I mean, so if you have these legislative leaders who basically control the CRC, I mean, they already have the authority to put stuff on the ballot. Why do you need a CRC to do it, I guess, is kind of my question about it. But
man, that's a good point, because the CRC, to a great extent, given the way the appointment process is made, these 37 members that are on the committee are all, you know, kind of representative of the interests of the legislature to a great extent, or the policymakers when it comes to, you know, the governor as well. So they during those many hearings that the CRC held last year leading up to their final package of amendments, there was plenty of politics going on. And the person who was the idea behind, who had basically had the idea behind bundling the amendments, is a Tallahassee lobbyist, Brecht Hutchin, who he was an appointee of Governor Rick Scott. And so, you know, it's not like this idea came out of you know, the masses or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't like the CRC, I mean, you it was the governor and the legislative leaders who were the ones who put them on there. So you would figure that the buck sort of stops with them. Like, it's kind of ironic that the legislature is criticizing the CRC when it was the legislative leaders who, you know, shaped the CRC by their appointments. But that being said, it does seem like sort of something that is from another era here. So it sounds like there's a pretty wide consensus to get rid of it. I mean, one of the arguments that I've heard that made for it is that it's easier for these appointees to vote for things and to advocate for things that might not necessarily be, you know, something that lawmakers want to cast a vote for, like ethics reform. It's harder to get the legislature to approve ethics reform because they're basically tying their own hands. And that that was one thing that the CRC did this year in terms of limiting lawmakers from being able to lobby after they leave office. You know, they had been unwilling to approve those things. So having that bit of distance between the legislature and having those appointees put those things on the ballot may have been the impetus that sort of got that issue over the hill. But Anyway, lastly, there's a new Florida poll out there that has a host of interesting data points for political nerds like us. The poll from Florida Atlantic University found that 75% of Floridians support universal background checks. That's a number that is sure to be cited during the gun control debates going forward. The poll has also found that Floridians believe Trump's tariffs on Chinese goods are hurting America. Some of the biggest takeaways, though, were numbers that touched on the presidential race here in Florida. It showed that Trump is faring fairly well against some of his top Democratic opponents. The poll found the president beating Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie Sanders in head-to-head matchups in Florida, although his margin of victory is within the poll's margin of error. Regardless, Trump is doing a lot better in Florida than he is nationally right now. An ABC Washington Post poll from last week had all of the Democratic presidential candidates beating Trump nationally. Biden was crushing Trump by 15 points in that national poll. But we all know it's not the popular vote that counts, but the Electoral College in Florida could be key for Trump if he's going to score another Electoral College win. And some other good news from the poll found his approval rating in Florida is on the rise, going from 47% in May to 49% in this latest survey. John, pretty good news for the president overall?
Well, it is definitely, you know, at least in Florida. You know, FAU has him faring better here than anywhere else. FAU has him positive in approval with 49 approved to 46 disapprove. That's rare nationally. Only the usually Republican-friendly Rasmussen Reports has him this high when it comes to surveys. He's more typically in the, you know, right now nationally, he's got a 53% disapproval rating, according to the website Real Clear Politics, which is kind of doing a daily roundup of polling. So, you know, it's very plausible, though, that among Florida voters that they're relatively pleased with his performance, especially the way the economy seems to be chugging along. And Florida, of course, you know, the nation's biggest swing state, still seems to default Republican in most races that don't have a Barack Obama on the ballot. And for Democrats, the FAU poll shows Elizabeth Warren doubling her support in Florida over the past 4 months, and that she's now within 10 percentage points of frontrunner Joe Biden. So that also seems to be something that's tracking what is being talked about nationally. So we've got maybe an emerging horse race on the Democratic side.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there was a lot of talk in the last cycle, presidential cycle, about how important Florida is, and it has been very important for, especially for Republicans. The pathway to an Electoral College victory for Republicans has seemed, at least in the past, to be very unlikely unless you win Florida. Now, Trump sort of turned that conventional wisdom on its head, and he was able to win Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And he actually could have won the Electoral College without winning Florida, because he won those three states that had traditionally have voted for Democrats for the president. But it's probably going to be hard for him to repeat that performance. Michigan and Wisconsin both elected a Democratic governor in 2018 and seem to be trending back towards Democrats after Trump's election. So if he loses Michigan, if he loses Pennsylvania, if he loses Wisconsin, Florida becomes absolutely critical for him and really a firewall for him here. So the fact that he's faring pretty good as he, you know, goes into a little bit more than a year away from the general election, I mean, these are fairly good numbers for him. And this is before he has, you know, started attacking his eventual opponent. So, you know, for Democrats, shows they have a lot of work to do here in Florida if they want to have a chance in this state. Well, we're going to move on to our final pick a number segment. John, you had a 65 this week. You want to say what that's all about?
I did. And 65 is the State House district number of Representative Chris Sprouls, who this week was chosen by his fellow Republicans to be Florida's next House Speaker, beginning after the 2020 elections. That's when he'll succeed current Speaker Jose Oliva. That's, of course, if the Republicans hold on to their majority, which looks like a virtual guarantee. Now, Sprouls is a 35-year-old lawyer, a former prosecutor from the Pinellas County city of Palm Harbor. He's married, father of two young children, and himself a cancer survivor as a teenager. Now, Sprouls, he's been in the House since 2014, and he had secured enough pledges about 3.5 years ago from his fellow Republicans to have the speakership lined up. That's kind of the way these things work. And so this week was kind of a formality, but it has some meaning. It's official, and it kills off any likely possibility of a palace coup within the Republican ranks, somebody trying to, you know, unseat him as the designated leader. That's probably not going to happen now. And Sprouls, you know, took a turn at the mic this week to talk about what he plans to do. And, you know, you can hear from him. No surprise, he's a conservative Republican. That's that follows a pattern in Florida going back 23 years now to when Republicans won the majority in the House after 122 years as the minority party. And but one thing Sprouls did say that caught a lot of people's ears, he talked about how, quote, Florida's prosperity is tied to our environment. And he said that we need to stop being afraid of words like climate change and sea level rise. He said that that's something that we do too often as conservatives. But coming after the era of former Governor Rick Scott, who avoided talk of climate change and sent this message through his agencies, this is a kind of a new theme coming from Florida Republicans. You're hearing a little bit of it, too, from Governor Ron DeSantis. Of course, you know, Sprouls, at the same time, he dismissed as he called it utter nonsense, the Green New Deal that is supported by many, you know, liberal Democrats, I guess you'd characterize. But he pretty much pledged support for doing something to help the state prepare for climate change. And that coming from a Republican House leader, that's something new.
Yeah, I mean, that is a new way of talking about it, to say that we need to stop being afraid of words like climate change, when the last governor was accused of banning his state employees from even using those terms, is a pretty interesting departure. So it would be interesting to watch Sprouls and see what kind of legislation he puts forward on stuff like that. Well, my number was 24, and I was kind of lazy this week and stuck with a number from the FAU poll. And John, you touched on my number already, but I'll elaborate a little bit. 24% is the percent of Democrats who support Elizabeth Warren in Florida. And as John mentioned, she has doubled her support from May, when she was at 12%. So Warren is now just 10 points behind Joe Biden. She's also a leapfrog. She's ahead of Bernie Sanders here in Florida. And, you know, they're kind of obviously seen as being in somewhat of the same lane as the more progressive candidates. But, you know, Bernie had a lot of support during the 2016 election, but he kind of struggled in Florida, and Hillary Clinton really crushed him here in Florida. But, you know, it looks like Elizabeth Warren has a better shot potentially of upsetting Joe Biden if the primary is still competitive by the time it gets to Florida. She seems to be surging right now, and that corresponds with her surge nationally. Florida traditionally has been a state that has supported maybe more moderate Democrats. Progressive firebrand Andrew Gillum fell short in the governor's race in 2018. He was kind of a big test of whether a progressive could do well here. So there's, I think, some skepticism that somebody, you know, like Warren could win in a Florida primary and win in Florida in the general election, but she seems to be doing well in the primary right now. She's on the rise. We'll see if she presents a threat to Biden if the race makes it this far. Well, that wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production team of Thomas Cordy, Joseph Forzano, and Adam Fish. And thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.